Committee will come to order. We have some amendments on House Bill 3925. Dan, would you come and please tell us about what amendments we should be looking at?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3925. You should have in front of you in your packet a dash two amendment, which is two pages long. In fact, it addresses two basic sections of the original bill. It deletes the reasonable reliance on land use regulations as part of the standard for providing evidence of a vested right. It adds substantial good faith expenditures to the standard. It adds the condition that the expenditures must have been made towards a use that was permitted at the time the owner made the expenditures. And it deletes a requirement for substantial findings by a court for a vested right to use to a use by a property owner. Section 3 applies to a claim for a vested right to use made in a circuit court on or after the effective date. And Section 3 also requires the Land Use Board of Appeals to dismiss without prejudice any pending claim or appellate claim proceeding upon the motion of the property owner on or after the effective date. Section 3 also allows a property owner to commence a declaratory judgment proceeding upon LUBA's dismissal of any pending claim or appellate claim. There is no revenue impact on the original bill, and in fact, I do not have a fiscal on the amendment. It has not been generated yet. There are two letters that have been recently passed out to you from the League of Oregon Cities and also the Association of Oregon Counties on this bill. With that, Mr. Crean is here to answer any questions.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Crean? Chris, do you want to give some testimony on these dash two, just specifically on the dash two amendments? Are they your amendments?
Yes, they are.
And why don't you just come and give us some brief testimony just on the amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chris Crean, speaking on behalf or in favor of House Bill 3925. The dash twos are built on the dash ones. The new section one is it's what we believe was taken from the dash one. Section one is the same as it was in the dash ones. We did add some. I met with cities and counties last Monday. We made some additional amendments in response to some concerns. Those are found on line 15, deleting language subject to review. And we rewrote section three, the applicability section, to make expressly clear that with one single exception, this bill operates prospectively only. It is not a retroactive bill with the exception of one case currently on appeal from Land Use Board of Appeals. So other than that, these are the same amendments we had before you 2 weeks ago.
So the dash two amendments make it clear that this measure deals prospectively only with one exception.
That is correct.
Please tell us about that exception.
There is an existing case, Fountain Village versus Multnomah County, that came up through the local land use process through the Land Use Board of Appeals. That was the case in which LUBA expressly stated they do not believe they have the authority to apply equitable principles to what is admittedly an equitable proceeding. It was that notion that first gave us the idea to bring this bill that really pointed out to us the disconnect between the type of proceeding this is and the type of right that is at stake and the type of local proceeding that it receives. So that's currently on appeal through the at the Court of Appeals. There's nothing in this bill that dismisses that case or that overturns the outcome in that case. We're not overturning any decisions. We're simply allowing all landowners in the state the right to seek a determination in circuit court. There's one landowner out there who we know right now who could take advantage of that, and we just made sure that landowner could, in fact, take advantage of this right that we are now offering to all landowners.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Garrard.
Mr. Crean, I have a question written down here from the first time we talked about this, and I want to make sure in my mind, a circuit court decision could override a LUBA decision on the same issue?
Generally speaking, the way the law is now, a decision goes either to LUBA or the circuit court. Appeals from LUBA go to the Court of Appeals. Appeals from circuit court go to the Court of Appeals. So generally, they deal with separate, they never interact, or very rarely interact. They have fairly exclusive jurisdictions. This would allow the landowner to seek a determination in circuit court instead of going through the local process and going to LUBA. So that if the landowner filed an action under this, it would never get to LUBA.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, follow up.
Follow up.
I guess my question is, if a landowner went to LUBA, mm-hmm. got a decision adverse to their position, could they then go to circuit court?
Yes, they could.
Thank you.
Yes, they could.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, there was a lot of background noise, and I may not have heard you properly there. If you've answered this, I didn't hear it. I apologize. Representative Garrard actually asked the question I think I'm most interested in. If you're going through an appeals process on vested interest, and you go to LUBA, you can go to a circuit court. In some way, this seems to say that you can go directly to the circuit court and avoid LUBA. Is that a correct assumption?
That's correct. We originally drafted the bill that jurisdiction would have been exclusively in the jurisdiction of circuit court for determining this kind of claim. In response to some concerns expressed by one county council who said he wanted to allow the option for a landowner to go to the local government and seek a determination, we thought, well, that's fine. So we removed the exclusive jurisdiction portion and said that the landowner simply has the right to go to circuit court if he so chooses.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So the landowner now under this bill would have a choice. He could go through a local government group into LUBA, or he could go directly to the circuit court.
That's correct. And we currently, the only way that this kind of claim can get into circuit court is if the local government issues an enforcement order. And remember the facts here. Somebody starts building something. They're midway through building it. The code changes in a way that doesn't allow them to build what it is, and they need to go get a determination that they have the right to finish building what they've already started. Currently, the only way that claim that you have a vested right to finish gets into circuit court is if the local government issues an enforcement order and tells you to stop working on what you're doing. That goes to circuit court, but that's at the local government's discretion. They can issue that order or not, or they can ask that you come in and go through the local process. So the local government currently has that option available to it. This simply allows the landowner the same option available to the local government.
Thank you.
Chris, is it true that what the local government would do if they were trying to keep the landowner from continuing to make the investment or the improvement, that they would seek an enforcement action? Is that the normal thing that one would anticipate?
You know, it's going to vary by jurisdiction. One of the things that works in favor of local government's local process is ORS 197-829 says that a reviewing body shall defer to a local government's interpretation of its own code. So when you go up to LUBA, if the local government's interpreting its own code, they get fairly strong deference. So a local government may feel inclined to require the landowner to go through its local process because then they gain the benefit of that deference. They'd lose that deference in circuit court, but there may be other cost reasons why it can be faster to go through circuit court. Also, you have evidence gathering tools available to you. You can compel testimony, subpoena documents, and so on in circuit court. So if you need those, then the local government might go to circuit court. So it's going to vary by jurisdiction.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Devlin?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cream, if to make this determination of whether you have a vested right or not, under the existing system, some cities and counties have two-tiered processes. I think a few actually have three-tiered processes in terms of approval authorities and appeal authorities before you actually can appeal to LUBA. In your experience, how long does it sometimes take to get through all of that process?
Oh, gosh. Well, as you know, last session we amended 215-428, and I think it was 428, and renumbered it 427 to extend the county deadline out to 150 days. The statutory deadline for cities is 120 days. I just got a simple land partition through Marion County's process in about 60 days. I've known other things to take, you know, the better part of a year asking for extensions while we finish this study or get that information. It can go on anywhere from 60 days to 6 months.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
If you're a party that has started construction on a process, and we all know that 99 times out of 100 or maybe even 999 times out of 1,000, local governments would be reasonable about this, but there might be one that would not. what sort of situation might that put you into in terms of contractual obligations if you've already have a contractor on site and you've got a stop order and...
Right. Well, that's a very good point. Thank you. If you're in mid-process and you've already selected your contractor, you may have bids out, or you may have one of the criteria here is you have to have expended a substantial sum in order to even qualify for a vested right. And so you've got all these liabilities hanging out there. And one of the suggestions that was made to amend this bill was to require a landowner to go through the local process and get a final land use decision before allowing them to go to circuit court. So you've got, then you're in mid-process, you've got all your liabilities hanging out there. Now you have to go, and you're in that 1 out of 1,000 case where the local government's dug in their heels and the landowner's dug in their heels. You're not going to agree. And so now you have to go through the local process before you can go to circuit court. That would take months. That would take months. And in the meantime, your liabilities are still hanging out there.
Final. And all that you're basically asking is to get a determination of what the law is.
That's correct. Yeah, and I would like to get on the record. We're not trying to change the substantive law here. There's a body of case law out there under Clackamas County versus Holmes, and we're not trying to change any of the substantive criteria. We're merely trying to allow the landowner to bring that claim in a different venue.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who would like to provide testimony on the Dash 2 amendments? We talked about the Dash 1 amendments, didn't we, Dan, last... Last time we considered this bill, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and those are included in the Dash 2 now. So.
Okay, so they're all together.
They're all together in the Dash 2.
Okay. Does anybody like to give any testimony on the Dash 2 amendments? Please come on forward.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Beaumont, and I'm a senior deputy city attorney for the City of Portland. The City of Portland joins the League of Oregon Cities in expressing concerns about this bill, and we urge a no vote on the bill because we believe it would fundamentally change the way vested rights determinations are made in Oregon. Currently, these determinations are made by local governments and can be appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals. House Bill 3925 would place jurisdiction to make these determinations in the circuit court through declaratory judgment actions. This change in procedure would bypass local governments altogether and eliminate participation by neighbors and citizens in vested rights determinations. We believe this change, even with the amendments proposed, would be bad policy for the following reasons. First, the bill is not needed to cure any serious problem. Most local codes do provide a vesting period for land use approvals, such as conditional uses, subdivisions, and plan unit developments. Similarly, state law now provides a vesting period for up to 10 years for subdivisions. We believe that these code provisions and statutory provisions are adequate. Second, we believe the process outlined in the bill is wasteful of judicial resources and is inconsistent with the state's policy of encouraging citizen participation in matters affecting land use. The legislature has determined that local governments are best equipped to make local land use decisions, and that the Land Use Board of Appeals is the appropriate forum for review of local land use decisions. Vested rights determinations are inherently land use decisions, and they involve the interpretation and application of local codes. This bill would undercut local processes for making vested rights determinations, eliminate citizen participation, and erode LUBA's jurisdiction. Third, by transferring vested right determinations from local governments to the courts, the bill makes it far more difficult for citizens who cannot afford lawyers to obtain or participate in vested rights determinations. Fourth, by giving circuit courts jurisdiction to decide vested rights questions, the bill greatly increases the risk of inconsistent determinations by circuit courts in different counties. Right now, LUBA is a single land use review body for the state. It has a well-developed body of case law on vested rights, and this bill is not needed as a law improvement measure and is not likely to result in speedier, more uniform vested rights determinations. Fifth, the underlying issue this bill seeks to address, whether a vested right to complete a partially built use can be lost through abandonment or discontinuance, is currently being litigated in the case of Fountain Village Development Company versus Multnomah County. That case is on appeal. There is nothing about LUBA's ruling in that case that suggests legislative action is needed or warranted before the judicial process has run its course. Further, there's nothing about LUBA's ruling that suggests legislative action is needed at all. LUBA's decision is a very straightforward review of a local land use decision. Finally, we disagree with the reading of the case law in which this bill is based. We did participate in a work group last week to discuss our differences with the proponents of this bill, and after an extended discussion, it became apparent that we do have very different policy perspectives that couldn't be reconciled as a result of that discussion. For the reasons outlined in my testimony, we respectfully urge the committee to vote no, to take no further action on this bill. I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you. Is the case that this bill retroactively reaches back to, is that the Multnomah County case?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
What's in the debate?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of torn on this bill, and I'd like to have a little more information. If a property owner goes to court and bypasses LUBA, in that court setting, don't local people have a chance to testify about what's happening? Aren't they, does the court allow them to testify in situations like that?
No. They are only allowed to participate if they actively intervene in the case or if they're called as witnesses. They don't have the same right to participate as citizens in a local land use process.
And they can't go to the court and say we'd like to petition the court to have a statement made?
They could, if they wish to hire a lawyer, they could petition the court to intervene, but they have no assurance that the court would allow them to do that. And again, it would require hiring a lawyer to represent them.
We've had some difficult situations with LUBA in Southern Oregon. People there often feel rather disenfranchised by them, that they make decisions that are contrary to what local people like to see happen sometimes. It's been a major point of confrontation in our rural area. I'm not sure it's over this particular issue. And so I have a tendency to think that if we offer another opportunity for landowners to have some rights to work with those in a different setting, that I'm not necessarily opposed to that. A landowner could go through local government, go through LUBA, look at the circuit court, is my understanding of this is now, or by this new law that would go straight to the circuit court if they so chose. Is that correct, my understanding?
That's right.
Is it true then that your position is that they should not be able to do that and they should go through local planning groups first?
It is our position that at the moment, under current law, vested rights determinations are land use decisions. Those are made by local governments, and that, like it or not, the scheme that has been put in place is that those land use decisions are appealable to LUBA and that it is the exclusive forum for review. And in many ways, that makes very good sense because a lot of the issues surrounding vested rights do involve local code interpretations. They are issues in which neighbors or others adjacent to the use may have valuable input, and there is the opportunity to sort through those issues at the local level, sometimes to work them out so that they never even reach the Land Use Board of Appeals.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
It was indicated in previous testimony that if an individual had gone through the LUBA process, and I believe the phrase was if an injunction wasn't handed down against the landowner, he would never right to go to circuit court. Is that your opinion also, or can you appeal direct to a circuit court if you disagree with LUBA's position?
If you disagree with LUBA's position, do you mean under the bill or under the current scheme?
Under the current scheme.
Under the current scheme, if you disagree with LUBA's decision, you appeal that to the Court of Appeals.
Irregardless of any action taken by a local government?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what you mean by your question. If a local government has initiated an enforcement action against a property owner and made it, you know, it's gone through a local hearings officer process and the hearings officer has issued a decision, that can be appealed to the circuit court. But an ordinary land use decision would go to LUBA and from LUBA to the Court of Appeals.
And the last question, same as Representative Devlin, how long would that take?
It really depends. I've handled many different land use cases. Very simple ones can go through the local government process and through LUBA in anywhere from 6 to 10 months. Very complex cases can take quite a bit longer.
Thank you.
I'd like to echo many of the sentiments that Representative Bates mentioned in regards to Southern Oregon. I really can't speak for any other areas, but there is very little confidence in LUBA in my area. And one of the statements that you made kind of reinforced the way I think I'm going to vote on this. And that is that you said LUBA will look at things from a statewide perspective in applying state rules. One of the things that we'd like to see in Eastern Oregon is that Eastern Oregon land use regulations, that somebody recognized we're different than Western Oregon, and LUBA has failed miserably to acknowledge that fact. So
I understand the point you've made. If you understood my point to be that LUBA will look at things from a statewide perspective, then I'm sorry, I didn't make my point clearly. My point was that at the moment, LUBA is a land use review body with jurisdiction over local land use decisions across the entire state. For any particular case, they evaluate it under the terms of the local code or any applicable statewide statute. So in reviewing a decision from a Southern Oregon city or county, they are not going to engage in a comparative analysis of how things work in Eastern or Western Oregon. They may look at applicable case law, which may come from elsewhere in the state, but they will evaluate it in terms of each jurisdiction's code.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How would you define vested right? What does it mean?
I think, LUBA defined it in the Fountain Village case, I think accurately, as the right to complete a use that was permitted or lawful at the time it was started. So it's a right to complete an emerging non-conforming use is basically what it is. The right to complete a use where you have gone far enough that the courts believe or answers the beliefs you should have the right to continue.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. If we were talking about a plan text amendment or a map amendment or or improvement of the development proposal, I could see the public participation requirement in that. But in determining whether or not someone had a right to do something and had, you know, in good faith proceeded, what's the nature of a public participation requirement in that?
Well, to the extent that there's a public process involved in making a vested right determination, I think neighbors potentially have valuable testimony to offer in terms of activity that's occurred on the property that would go toward toward construction, that was construction type activity to complete the use. I think neighbors and surrounding property owners can provide valuable testimony or insight in that process. Many local vested rights determinations are made. Some vested rights determinations are made without a public hearing or without a public hearing process. Many of them are resolved through discussion with the planners or through local government officials.
But in circuit court, even if it was without all public process, if you were defending a city's action, wouldn't you have the ability to introduce any evidence that you wanted to introduce, whether that maybe isn't in the form of public testimony, but in terms of actually presenting a brief? And
I'd have the opportunity to introduce any evidence that the circuit court allowed me to introduce and felt that
which
was
they
relevant.
Thought relevant to the.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We are in work session. Representative Cano.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3925.
Two amendments to House Bill 3925. Is there any objection to the dash two amendments? So ordered. Representative Cano.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3925 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Cano moves House Bill 3925 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Debate.
I'm going to investigate this a little bit further. My understanding of the bill now, I'm going to vote yes on it. I think it represents a step forward for small landowners, especially in Southern Oregon. But I want to look at it a little more carefully. I want to be clear with you that it's a yes vote now, and we'll probably say yes vote on the floor, and I would discuss if there's any change.
Thank you. Senator Burrard?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. We have a lot of discussions going on in this legislature about usurping local control. this is a bill that I think restores more local control in that an appeal of a land use decision would go, at least the property owner would have the opportunity to go to a circuit court who is a local judge versus relying on a statewide organization such as LUBA to make a decision regarding land use. So I feel that's reinforcing more local control as far as where the decisions are being made versus the way it is presently.
Thank you. Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I said at the last hearing at this bill that I would inquire with the Department of Land Conservation and Development what their position was on the bill. I don't know if they're publicly making the position, but in my inquiry they indicated that they were neutral on the bill. So I'll be voting in favor.
Anything else? Yeah, I would add, I found Representative Devlin's questions very helpful here today. And in fact, it seems to me that if there is a vested right, the court is the appropriate place to go to make that determination. And I am mindful of the costs imposed upon the landowner in terms of the investment and the delay in continuing the improvements on the property. So I think this gives some basic substantive rights to the landowner, the property owner, to get determination in a more expeditious manner relative to his or her vested right. And I think the appropriate place to do that is in circuit court. So with that, Dan, please call the roll on the motion.
Representative Bates?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Devlin? Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Canope?
Aye.
Representative Crummell, excuse. Representative Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
No.
Representative Witt?
Aye. House Bill 3925, as amended, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Girard, would you please carry the bill?
Certainly.
Thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 3925. Open a work session on House Bill 3424. Dan, would you tell us? I think we have some amendments on that bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3424. In front of you should be a -2 amendment. With regard to the -2 amendment, I've encapsulated on the summary what it does, but in fact, it directs that a public contracting agency include a copy of those first-tier subcontractors with a notification of the award of a contract to Boley. So, in essence, it only amends one portion of law, ORS 279.363. What you've seen previously had also required some additional things, some public notice, posting a public notice. And this bill quite simply just says send the list of the first-tier subcontractors with the notice of the award of the contract to Boley. And that is the -2 amendment. I have, there is a no revenue impact statement on the -2 amendment. I do not have a fiscal impact on the -2.
Mr. Carlson, would you come forward?
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is, for the record, Jeff Carlson. I represent Ironworkers Local 29, and I'm here to support the -2 amendments to House Bill 3424. Just briefly, the amendments were worked out 1 week ago in this committee. The City of Portland had an issue, and we've resolved the issue, and I believe Mark is okay with the amendments that, as they sit in front of you. Essentially, what we've done is we've deleted lines 4 through 12 and added a new section 1, and it just specifies that we're dealing with construction only and the first-tier subcontractors.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Carlson? Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you say that they are supposed to make their contract available to the public, where do you do that? In the paper, or do you report it to bully, or what do you do?
Madam Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, the document that exists, the WH-81 document, is a public document that rests with the Bureau of Labor and Industry. And so if I wanted access to that document, I would go to the Bureau of Labor and can get access.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Carlson? Representative Monis Anderson.
You might have stated this, but did you say that Boley, will they be able to handle this? I mean, is this...
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, I've talked to the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industry, and he is no opposition to the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carlson. Thank you. We're now in work session, so no additional testimony.
You can invite it if you'd like, Representative.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on HB 3424? Okay.
Representative Johnson?
Representative Witt?
Yeah, I move, what's the dash two amendments? I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3424.
Is there any objection? If not, so ordered.
Madam Chair?
Representative Witt?
I move House Bill 3424 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
Representative Crummell would like to say.
Thank you. Is there any additional discussion?
That would have been a good picture, Mr.
Representative Crummell had an emergency.
There being no other discussion, I would ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Bates.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Girard.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Canope.
Aye.
The other Representative Crummell. Excuse. Representative Monis Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Walker.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
We need a carrier, and I would ask that Dr. Bates. Thank you, sir. It's House Bill 3424 as amended moves to the floor, and Representative Bates will carry it.
With a due pass recommendation.
With a due pass recommendation. Thank you. You guys can drag me through this.
Yeah, I'm sure. Close the work session.
Okay, that closes the work session. We now are going to do which one? Okay. We're now going to open a work session on House Bill 2980.
Mr. Chandler needs to know.
And Dan, do you want to tell us where we are?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I just received the dash one amendment. It does not match the staff measure summary that you have in front of you because the amendment was just produced. I do want to remind the committee that it does have a subsequent referral to revenue. And with that, Mr. Chandler is here to provide explanation for us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clem. I'd invite Mr. Chandler to come forward. Mr. Chandler and Ed Al.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Building Industry Association, here on behalf of House Bill 2980, the dash one amendments thereto. Joining me at the table is Michelle Deister, League of Oregon Cities, B.J. Smith, Clackamas County, and Association of Oregon Counties. We also just received the dash one amendments. I think the counties and cities would like to make a short statement before we go through them, and we'll walk the committee through the amendments if that's the committee's pleasure. I personally would like to thank my colleagues sitting at the table and those in the league and City of Portland, or excuse me, the Special District Association, City of Portland, to work very hard crafting these. It's a good product, and I think we will be, it'll do the state well, the industry well, and local governments well, and I do appreciate their time.
Thank you very much, and I don't know which order you two would like to.
I think that decides that. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities, and I would just like to reiterate what John said in terms of all of us working together to sit down and craft something that responds to our mutual concerns. And I think having just received these amendments, as we move forward, there may be additional technical changes that come to light as we go through these, but I think that these amendments really do reflect the issues that the work group has been discussing.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Ms. Deister? Thank you. BJ?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm BJ Smith. I'm the Government Relations Director for Clackamas County. We are one of the, not every county has systems development charges, but we are one of the larger counties that do. So that is, that kind of explains my interest in this. I also have been involved in the systems development charge law for about 12 years since it was initially enacted. And the one thing that I would add is that this law is important to the relationship between builders and local government, because if we do not end up with a good funding stream to create infrastructure capacity, both government and the builders are at a great disadvantage in the local communities. For about 10 years, we have tried to follow this route of having work groups that will work on changes to the law that are agreeable to both sides, and that's what we've been doing for the last 2 or 3 months. It does take a while because the words are very important that we use in the law, but I think that this is progressing fairly well.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you. Then, Mr. Chandler, I think we'll return to you and ask you to help the committee walk through the dash ones.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just starting on page one of the bill, I'll just highlight the changes. If you have questions about system development charge methodology operation at any point, stop me, and I'll back up and explain the context within which I'm talking. But otherwise, I'll just highlight the amendments. The first one, appearing on lines 9 and 10, is a technical correction. You'll notice that the language, absent the bold print, allows for the Bancrofting, which is a financing mechanism local governments often use, for system development charges for streets, community water systems, storm sewer, sewerage, not parks. None of us involved in this process are quite sure why exactly parks didn't make the cut when it came to Bancroft authority. I know personally of a couple of parks that had been Bancrofted, but the bond council didn't catch that. This change makes it official for Bancrofting parks SDCs, which will keep everybody out of the federal joint, which is a good thing. On page 2, lines 14 through 16, this is in the definition section, tells what SDCs can and cannot be charged for, or the defines the terms of what they can be charged for. We're putting in the concept of increased use. As elsewhere in the bill, you'll see that we talk about increased use by existing users. And the concept here is clearly if you build a new house or a new store, you're putting a demand on the system, an SDC can be triggered. It isn't so clear as to what happens if you add on to an existing house, an existing store, put demands on the on system capacity in that fashion. The definition here, including the definition, is intended to make it clear that if you do add new bathrooms, additional garage spaces, whatever it might, additional parking, that even though it's an existing user, that can trigger an SDC, just, and that's the same thing as a new construction would. Next page.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I've lost you on the definition or the explanation for subsection 3 on that page. Can you explain it what increased use, what do you mean by that?
Let me, if I may, let me jump forward in the bill to page 4, I believe it is. I'll get, and I'm just to provide the context. We're talking here about, on this page, the amendment language, looking at line 17 through 19 on page 4, capital improvements for the projected need for system capacity attributable to new users or to increased use by existing users. Currently, doing it for new users is the stereotypical case. That's where a new home is constructed, a new office building. What we're trying to get at with adding increased use by existing users and then defining the term increased use in section 3 on page 2 is to separate out those situations where there's an existing structure, let's say an office building or an industrial plant, that adds parking. And clearly then that is going to add more trips onto the highway. If that jurisdiction has an SDC, if there's a new building built with the same amount of parking, they would be paying an SDC. this will make it clear that that expansion of that existing use.
It could be used for that.
Is the equivalent of a new use, essentially.
Thank you.
Does that help?
Yep.
Good, thank you.
Proceed ahead.
Thank you. On page 3, line 15, this is a change letter that council made. It's a good one, deleting the words "and not otherwise," the end of line 15 and line 16, and inserting the word "judicially." One of the, as Ms. Smith indicated, as system development charges were implemented, or adopted and then implemented over the years, there has been this partnership of sorts between local government and the development industry, because we recognize the need for the infrastructure and the need for local government to get the money to pay for it. One of the things that's very important to local government is that these charges be evaluated through a writ of review process, which is what the cross-reference there to ORS 34010 to 34.100. This section here just simply says that we're making clear this is a judicial determination through a writ of review. Elsewhere in the bill, it states, and the current law states, that it's not a land use decision. So this is simply, this section here is talking about the review process. And the next amendment kind of relates to this. And the intent here, and this is one of the areas that Ms. Deister mentioned, where there's a technical problem of the drafting, and we'll be, as the bill goes down to revenue, we'll continue working on it. Our intent, though, agreed upon intent, is that under current law, you can challenge the methodology. When a jurisdiction adopts a system development charge, they adopt a methodology to support it. And the methodology is what is available for public comment. We're going to talk about that here in a minute. And the methodology is what is subject to a writ of review. And a writ of review is a very short time frame for someone that wants to challenge it to go to court. So the local government is assured that within a very short period of time, they're either in a fight or they're done and they're fine. What we're saying on the line 17 through 25 is that oftentimes the SDC was adopted and several years and stays in effect for a number of years. The methodology was done, the writ of review time for challenging that methodology has expired, but there are situations where someone comes in with a project, when a development comes along and wants to argue that I'm not generating the trips, the highway trips that your methodology says based on my type of construction that you think I am. I'm not creating the impact on the system. I'm using a different kind of landscaping. I'm not putting as much demand on the water supply, whatever it might be. And under current law, it's very unclear as to whether or not that individual could challenge not the methodology that set the fee, but the application, the mathematical calculation of the methodology to their particular project. And the intent on line 17 through 25 is to say, yes, you can. You can do that. It cannot challenge the methodology, but you can challenge the application of it. You do it through a writ of review. But if the local government has a process, an appeal process, then you have to follow that. They have to tell you what it is, but you have to go through that first before you end up going to court.
Madam Chair.
Representative Witt.
Yeah, Mr. Chandler, what if the government unit has not adopted an administrative review procedure?
That's the technical glitch I was referring to, Mr. Chairman, or Mr. Chairman at the moment.
What is the intention there?
The intention is that if the local government has a procedure, they tell you about it, you follow that first. If they don't have a procedure, you go to circuit court on a writ of review. But they have to tell you at the front end, and the drafting didn't reflect that agreement, but that is the agreed upon intent.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
This is to, I think, to the city here. Section 3 of this bill, the original bill, and then 3A, B, and C following it, 3 appears to say that if the fees are collected unlawfully, that the government agency will pay double the cost of the charges. Is that acceptable to you?
As originally drafted, no, it was not. And that is one of those things that we have basically discussed amongst ourselves and come up with a suitable compromise in terms of how to deal with as applied to challenges, as Mr. Chandler was just So,
is that language still in all
of
No.
Madam Chair, if I might, I should have mentioned this at the outset. I apologize for not doing it. What you have in front of you with the Dash 1 amendments is essentially a gut and stuff of our own bill. That we did it that way.
So referencing back and forth.
Work off of the Dash 1 only. I do apologize for not making that clear.
God, I'm crazy.
And the exact reason that you were having trouble following this representative base is why we decided just to replace the whole bill and do a new one, because it's much simpler to do it that way than back and forthing with the amendment. I apologize for not making that clear. Any other questions on that portion before I move on?
You might have said it, but I need a further explanation on line 15 when you deleted "and not otherwise." Does this mean they cannot? It says, starting on line 14, "the decision of the governmental unit shall be judicially reviewed only as provided in ORS 3401234.100 and not otherwise," meaning there's no other recourse. What was the otherwise? I mean, what would, does this mean that maybe they can do something otherwise now because it's deleted?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullins Anderson, I'll defer to Ms. Smith, who actually was here when it was adopted. I came right thereafter, but I think the "as and not otherwise" was kind of a belt and suspenders approach. Mm-hmm. The word "only" in that sentence, I think, makes it very clear that your judicial review is through the writ of review, not something else.
And I, Representative Mullins Anderson, I do believe that the intent was originally that the judicial review, the writ of review, was the exclusive remedy. And by dropping this language, I think it was, this is a drafting change that was made in legislative council because it was redundant, the word "only."
Okay.
Still can, means that we have an exclusive remedy.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Chairman, would you continue?
We're on section 4 now, page 3 of the dash ones. On line 29, there is the insertion of the word "modified." That was part of our agreement with local government that this not only applied to the amendment or the establishment of the SPC, but also modifications to it. And we, later in the bill, you'll see we define what modifications consist of. We added on line 31, and this, by the way, this section we're talking about here is reimbursement fees, and I'll be very brief, but this is an important point if you don't do SPCs on a regular basis. There are two basic kinds. There are reimbursement fees and improvement fees. A reimbursement fee is where the local government has, let's say, a sewage treatment plant that has excess capacity. A new development occurs, the local government can essentially sell them through a reimbursement fee the extra capacity that they've already paid for, that the local government has already bought. It's a good thing. Then improvement fees are where they do not have a sewage treatment plant. They need one to service development, and the SDCs are used to construct the plant in the first place. And the distinction shows up, you'll see as you go through, we go through this several places. This is one of them where we're talking about reimbursement fees, and the change on line 31 is to insert the language "gifts or grants from federal or state government or private persons" as things that have to be considered when they're looking at the calculation of the reimbursement fee. And the logic there is if a local government has, let's say, a park that was given to them by someone or a water plant that was paid for in whole or in part by the federal government, then their reimbursement fee should be calculated only on the part that the local government's on the hook for, not for the portion that was given to them from some outside source, as a matter of fairness in the calculation of the fee.
Chair.
Representative Mullins Anderson.
It seems sort of cumbersome to be, or I maybe have like you to explain to me, how can you know what the value or cost of the capital improvements? Is this done after? Is this particular SDCs? I know you don't like that word, but is this only? How do you determine it? When it, I think it could vary from capital project to capital project, and how would you really know what that cost is? Or maybe that's is it based on the original contract, or after all the work orders are in, or How is this going to happen?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullins Anderson, folks a lot smarter than I do that calculation. If you look at this section, starting on page on line 29 of page 3 and going over through page line 3 of page 4, the current law talks about the things they have to look at in calculating a reimbursement fee. The cost of the facility, prior contributions by existing users, the value of unused capacity, rate-making principles employed to finance public improvements, and other relevant factors. It's a very complicated process. I couldn't begin to tell you, frankly, how it works. There are municipal finance officers, and when we've worked on these bills in the past, we tend to rely on those folks to tell us what works and what doesn't work when we start fiddling with things. one of the reasons that this doesn't get fiddled with very often, frankly, is that it is pretty complicated from a financing standpoint.
Who would do the follow-up?
Follow-up.
Who would do it, like in Clackamas County? Who would determine that?
Madam Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, a local government will usually obtain the services of a methodology expert in developing the SDC. And there are two answers to your question, I think. There are two answers that I would offer. One is under a reimbursement fee. That's a facility that has already been constructed. The costs are already known. And you simply subtract out any gifts or grants that you have from that cost and then set your charges. In an improvement fee, you are working on the basis of estimated charges for a particular capital improvement structure that you want to build, and you are also factoring into that the estimated time that you are going to construct that, whether it's 2 years in advance or 5 years in advance, and you build those into basically a present worth analysis. That is usually a piece of work that is contracted out by most governments. There are people that specialize in setting methodologies, and then the local government sets the fees after that technical consultant has provided a report back.
Soldier on, Mr. Chandler.
I think we're on page 4, line 4, bold letter large, capital B. This change says be calculated to recover only the value or cost of capital improvements, system capacity attributable to new users or increased use by existing. The wording is not exactly what we discussed with Legislative Council, but the concept here that we've agreed upon is that to put some limits on what reimbursement fees can be charged for, to highlight out that the number we're seeking is that amount of the extra capacity that is attributable to new users or to the increased use by existing. In other words, the use of a reimbursement fee should not result in, from our standpoint, in a windfall to local government. From their standpoint, should be one that they can clearly draw a line between the increased use and the imposition of the fee. Moving on.
Proceed ahead.
Line 7, a change just to clarify the fact that we're now talking about both establishment and modification of these fees, and moving some language up from line 10, which council believe that would read better. The next significant change is on line 17 to 19, and this is in the improvement fee section. You remember we had the reimbursement and improvement fees. This section here talks about improvement fees. The language on line 17 to 19 is essentially a parallel of the language on lines 4 to 6. It's looking at that issue of the cost attributable to the development. This is one of those things that most of us thought was implicit. There have been some situations that turned out that it was not so implicit, so we're making it explicit. Questions on that? The next change, other than insertion of modify or that series of phrases, appear on line 27 and line 31, page 5, where we're expanding time from 45 to 90 days and from 30 to 60 days. As I mentioned earlier, the use of the writ of review is a very important part of this agreement with local government. The current law, which allows for a 45-day notice and a 30-day review of a oftentimes a very complicated methodology, simply doesn't give anyone who wants to challenge that enough time to challenge it. Because as Ms. Smith noted, most local governments hire a consultant or an expert to prepare the methodology. I've been involved in a few SDC challenges, and typically I have to go hire a consultant or an expert myself. 30 days isn't enough time to do that. And they've very graciously allowed the expansion of that time frame, and we've agreed not to sue them very often. That was a joke. or at least no more often than we have. The next significant change, other than minor wording changes, is on line 13 through 16 of page 6. And this is where Legislative Council put the definition of a modification. In a future iteration of this, it may end up being moved up someplace else, but the idea here is that local governments can build into their system development charge methodology an automatic price escalator specific cost index is what we're calling it here, and that the operation of that index is not an amendment for purposes of triggering all the other requirements of modifying a system development charge. That's helpful for them. It's also helpful for us to know in advance what the fees are going to be and how often they're going to ratchet up or down. In Section 5, page 6, lines 17 through 25, we made a series of changes that clarified what we thought was the law already. It turned out, and I didn't realize this myself, that you did not have to have a capital improvement plan before you did an SDC. You could do it the other way around. I know of only one jurisdiction who spotted that little loophole. We are, with this bill now, nailing it shut again. This says that before you do an SDC, you have to have a list of stuff that you're going to, that you hope to build with it, and that the list has to be maintained, prepared by the local government, maintained by them, but that they can modify them or the plan or the list at any time as long as that does not trigger a change in the methodology. Section 6, line 31, this deals with the issue of accountability, where local governments prepare an annual accounting. We put a date in there. October 1 may not be the date we end up with, but there will be a date set that these annual accountings will be done by. And then on page 7, lines 3 through 5, we're stating that in that annual accounting needs to be a list of what was spent on what projects from system development charge revenue, so that there's some way of tracking collections and expenditures and projects on the list to make sure that the system is going forward in the way that it should. The final change is more minor modification, adding the word modification to the list of things that say it is not a land use decision. And with that, Madam Chair.
Any questions for Mr. Chandler or Ms. Smith or Ms. Dyster?
Madam Chair.
Representative Witt.
Is it safe to assume that other than a couple technical amendments that still have to be fixed in the bill, that everybody is in agreement on the bill going forward?
Yes.
Who is that, everybody? We had several League of Women Voters and 1,000 Friends and...
I'm talking about the folks here, Representative.
Okay.
I mean, and who they represent.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, at least for Clackamas County, and I believe for the Association of Oregon Counties, who have had a chance to look at the revisions, that the revisions are in a direction that are supportable. There may be some minor changes in language, but a lot of people have not seen the revisions that the work group has been working on, and that may confuse some folks as to what the agreement is about, that it is this this product that we're bringing today.
Perhaps I could ask a question that would help some of us. There have been several other system development charge bills. Your collaboration specifically spoke to this bill and doesn't go beyond the sideboards of this bill, regardless of what other draft bills may be floating around.
That's a correct statement on our part.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Devlin, did you have a question?
No.
Madam Chair.
Representative Witt.
I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2980.
Is there objection? There being none?
Hey, Madam Chair.
Representative Witt.
I move House Bill 2980. Now, this has a subsequent to referral to revenue, right? Representative Devlin.
Well. Question before
you. Go ahead.
Either of the parties, either of the three parties. The remaining issues can be worked out in revenue, like if there are issues.
The original.
Yes.
We are continuing to meet and to look at the language, inspect the language that was just provided to us.
If I may, just to clarify, we've had in our work group, City of Portland Special District Association, and the folks here at the table working. I've sent it out to my folks, they're sending it out to their folks. I have every expectation that the only upcoming changes will be the and the type corrections, and we can certainly handle those in revenue.
Madam Chair,
Representative Monsignor.
One other further question. Is this, because the language is stated such, is this a cap system on developmental charges? Is it worded so that there is a cap?
Madam Chair, Representative Moulton said no.
Madam Chair. Representative Bates.
Since this will be coming revenue and we'll be seeing you there again, would it be possible for you to contact the League of Cities, League of Women Voters, and Thousands of Friends and get their view on the Dash One amendments? Not they have to agree with you, just want their view.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Oh, yeah.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was there an amendment for school SDCs on here?
Ma'am, are you, do you have a copy of the, the main bill?
Dream on.
After Mr. Chandler heard you, Representative Walker, would you repeat your question?
I don't think he either. He would have fallen out of his chair.
No. Madam Chair, Representative Walker, I was waiting for that because I would like to call your attention to the relating clause on the bill.
To the which clause?
The relating clause.
The relating clause?
Yes.
Oh, my I just thought I'd give you a little heart attack this morning.
No, ma'am.
Representative Witt.
Neener.
If I can make the motion, I would I move House Bill 2980 as amended to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Witt has moved House Bill 2980 as amended to the Revenue Committee. Is there any discussion? With a due pass recommendation, is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I'll be.
Representative Bates.
I'll be voting yes, but reserve the right to change my vote in revenue.
Thank you, Representative. Any other, Representative Brard?
We don't have system development charges in Klamath County, but we do in the city of Klamath Falls, so I'm glad, Michelle, you're okay with this thing. But I'm going to be like Representative Bates and put my position that I could go another way if the cities find some real problems with this.
Thank you, Representative Brard.
Madam Chair.
Representative Witt.
I think it's wonderful that the interests here that were opposed on this bill originally have come together and it's sought some common ground on language, and I commend all of you for that. Because I know this was a bill that created some real concern for the cities and the counties, and I appreciate the work that you've put in on it. I think you've come up with a product here that's going to work and it's going to help everybody all around. So
thank you, Representative.
Glad to get forward.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Is there any other discussion? If not, then the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bates?
Yes.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Carlson?
Excuse.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Canope?
Aye.
Representative Crummell? Excuse. Representative Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
All right. House Bill 2980, as amended, moves to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. Thank you very much, and we'll close the work session. We'll now open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 268A and ask Ms. Representative King to come forward.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grant.
It might be pointed out that this marks two consecutive votes that Representative Walker has voted aye on, and I think that that probably deserves some kind of notation.
Thank you, Representative Grant. Noted for the record. Representative King, thank you for joining us.
It was nice.
We have a chance for a hat trick then.
A hat trick? No, a lemon trick would be good.
Senate Bill 268.
Madam Chair.
Representative Witt.
Public hearing.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. For the record, Al King, State Representative, House District 44. And I wanted to have a moment to comment on Senate Bill 268 with you, as I did over on the Senate. Some of you would know that I do have a life health insurance license, and in that capacity, and also as a securities broker, I do a lot of work in interstate licensing, and it does get to be extremely complex. And rather than going through a statement, I think that an analysis comment provided by the department would be most helpful and succinct. It's a pretty large bill. It's got a lot of complexity to it, but this is a very clean bill. Under the Federal Grain Leach Bliley Act, which took effect in 1999, states now have the option of conforming their licensing laws to facilitate reciprocal licensing to adopt uniform insurance licensing. And the states have until 2002 of November 2002 to establish the reciprocal licensing procedures, and that's based on model legislation drafted by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And the downside is that if the state of Oregon didn't do this, if an adequate number of states did not do this, then that licensing would be done by the feds instead of by the states. Certainly a worthwhile purpose and saves, probably us some money, certainly, saves, the entities that deal with multi-state, reciprocal state licensing better. It also potentially has the benefit of improving competition. For example, with different licensing procedures, I would not go through the trouble of licensing in Washington or California, and as a result would not compete for any business there, and I would assume reciprocally. So clean bill, and I would urge passage.
Thank you very much, Representative King. Mr. Ariel, I know that you're here from the agency. Would you like to add anything, or are you here simply as a resource?
I can add a little bit.
But please join us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ariel. I'm the insurance administrator in Oregon, and with me is Lou Littlehales, our legislative counsel. Representative King, I think, did a great job of summarizing why we need this bill. It accomplishes two basic purposes for us. One, it allows a resident agent in another state to come into Oregon as a non-resident through a much more streamlined process than is currently possible, and that's an important thing in the market today, with so many of the agent workforce working in multiple states, and many of them in as many as all 50 states. The second thing it does is to make our laws more consistent and uniform with the laws of other states. That also is important for the business of insurance, which is increasingly an interstate business. The bill that you have in front of you is a consensus bill. We spent a long time working with all of the stakeholder groups to achieve the consensus that we have. The bill passed the Senate 27-1. It's good for efficiency, and it's also good for consumer interest. There are a number of features here that will make it easier for consumers to weed out the agents who really are the few bad apples in the business. The last thing I'll do here, without getting any more of the details, I wanted to just highlight two issues, one that came over from the Senate and the other that's the subject of some amendments that are in front of you. The first thing that came over from the Senate was the so-called felony waiver provision in this bill. What that provision does is allows us to review the record of someone who's in the insurance business but has a felony, and usually when we see these, the felony is maybe 20 or even 30 years old. It allows us to review those cases and determine whether the person can still be in the business of insurance. Now, the important point about this provision is that we already have the authority to do that with licensed personnel. So agents, consultants, and people that we already license, we've had that authority for a long time, and we continue to have it to review those cases. We don't grant very many of those waivers, but there are cases that we see where a felony's 20 or 30 years old and the person has been involved in productive enterprise, maybe even in the insurance industry, predating this federal law that required them to get these waivers. And so that business goes on. What this bill adds to that is the federal law that created this need for felony waivers is a 1994 law, and it applied not only to agents and other licensed personnel, but it applied to all people who are employed in the industry, including, say, the janitor in an insurance company. Anybody that works for an insurance company has to get a waiver if they have a prior felony. And what the bill does is closes this little loophole in the law where we can give those kind of waivers to agents, but we couldn't give them to, say, the janitor. And so the bill allows us, if we get an application from that kind of person, to grant the so-called felony waiver. It's explained in the letter that's addressed to Senator Corcoran that is in your packet. The other issue is there's a -3 amendments in front of you from H&R Block, and I believe that Mr. Kobus talked to a number of you about those amendments. We spoke ahead of the hearing and determined that we could satisfy his concern through an administrative process inside the agency, and then he's agreed and his client has agreed that they don't need that amendment. You probably want to double check that with him, but that was our agreement just before the hearing. So that would take that amendment off the table. And then we believe there are no other amendments necessary to the bill. We haven't seen any others that are necessary. So we'd urge the committee to pass this bill onto the House floor. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Ariel? Thank you very much. No one else has signed up to testify, but would anyone else care to? Ms. Butterfield? But you want to come up to the table, please, and identify yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for inviting me up. You have my written testimony. I'm Mona Butterfield with the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho. I had a couple peers in the room, and they left because they didn't think they needed to be up here. We worked very hard for over a year on this bill. I have a big book that's about this thick, full of issues that we looked at. We're all very happy with the bill, so we support it.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Butterfield? Thank you, Ms. Butterfield. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 268? There being none, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 268.
Madam Chair.
Representative Witt.
I move Senate Bill 268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion?
Question.
Representative Carlson.
The Dash 3 amendments that are in my files, those were...
They were considered, but then they determined that the first
they don't want
concern
them.
They didn't.
Okay. All right. Is there any other discussion? Representative Monis Anderson.
And why isn't this going to revenue since, is it because the cost is going to, oh, it's a decrease in cost, isn't it?
Yes.
They're going to, in 2003 to 2005, at least the fiscal page. Mm-hmm. So that's because it's not occurring in this biennium, is that correct?
Representative King, would you like to come forward if you can answer that question?
Yeah, I can answer the question.
Mr. Clem can answer the question. Please go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative Monis Anderson. This came from I believe the Revenue Committee. Correction. It came from the Senate Committee on Business, Labor, and Economic Development with no revenue impact whatsoever. And in fact, the fiscal statement hopefully is in your packet, which indicates no impact on the current biennium or this next biennium, and then a loss of two positions in the 03 to 05 biennium. So, in fact, it does. Both impact statements have been issued for this bill the way you're seeing it today.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? There being none, Representative Witt has moved Senate Bill 268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bates.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Garrard.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Canope.
Aye.
Representative Crummell. Excuse. Representative Monis Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Walker.
Excuse.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
And we need a carrier. Representative Carlson. Thank you very much. All right. We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 580A.
And we have...
And invite forward Nikki Witte from Coos County.
Yes.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead and offer your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nikki Witte. I'm a Coos County Commissioner. This is one of three bills that we have introduced to change the statutes dealing with county treasurers. This one eliminates the requirement that the county treasurer register bonds and manage bond proceeds. Our own county treasurer has been in that office a long time and said it's probably been over 20 years since she's had the need to do that job. You'll want to know that the Oregon Treasury did review the bill, and the only amendment they had was to tighten up our language in which banks and financial institutions can be used as a depository. And so the amendment lists the ones that the legislature has already identified in 295005.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Ms. Witte? Commissioner Witte, excuse me.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crossland.
Just to clarify on the amendment again, this was an amendment that actually got put into the A and Grossville and...
That's needed.
You're not proposing any additional amendments at this time?
No. The Revenue Committee passed it out unanimously, and I don't think there were any no votes on the Senate side, and the only amendment we had on the Senate side was the depository.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Hasina, do you have something you want to add?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association. Senate Bill 580 does incorporate a number of changes into many different special district statutes, health districts, and we're supportive of this legislation.
Any questions for Ms. Squires?
Yes.
Representative Devlin.
Are you aware of any opposition to the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Devlin, no, I'm not.
Representative Montes Anderson.
Why isn't the AOC here, Association of Oregon Counties?
Well, this is evidently the County Association of Treasurers has wanted to do these bills that we've helped them with for years and years, and just nobody's ever stepped forward. So the chair or the legislative person for the County Treasurers Association sits with me on AOC's legislative committee. And so I took them to him and said, do you want us to do this? And he said, that would be great.
Great.
So that's how they got
Thank
here.
You.
I think I just opened the public hearing. Sorry about that. But we can... Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 580? There being none, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 580. No.
Madam Chair. Move Senate Bill 580 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Canope has moved Senate Bill 588 to the Senate floor with a, I mean, to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? There being none, the clerk will call a roll.
Representative Bates.
I believe the horses have seen the barn, yes.
Representative Brown. Excuse. Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Girard.
Excused.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Canope.
Aye.
Representative Crummell. Excused. Representative Montes Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Walker.
Aye.
Representative Witt. Excused.
And we need a carrier. How about Representative Canope?
I'd make a motion to put this on the consent calendar.
We're all looking at you, Representative Walker. There's been a motion to put this on the consent calendar.
It's like a 30-0 vote out of the Senate.
Yeah, I have no problem with this one. Thank you for asking me.
Dan, do we need to call the roll on
any objections?
Is there any objection?
Hearing none.
Hearing none, it's moved to the consent calendar. There being no other business before the committee, it's my joy to adjourn us before 5.